This weekend, the Kramerata Baltica, a group that was founded and is led by violinist Gidon Kramer, will play Beethoven's 14th String Quartet in Berkeley, California. In this case, it's scored for chamber orchestra. This is kind of a big deal, both because the piece, the Opus 131, as it's also known, isn't heard very often, especially performed by elite-level artists, and also because it's argued by a few important music types to be the greatest piece of music ever composed in the history of Western music. Schubert had a Sgt. Pepper's response after hearing it, recognizing that music had just jumped pretty significantly forward. If you check the top classical works of all time, you probably won't find it there. The Ninth Symphony is generally voted on top, and other Beethoven pieces like the Fifth Symphony or the Fifth Piano Concerto show up on the list, as well as the Moonlight Sonata, which was scored in C sharp minor. That's an interesting key. It's not the saddest of all keys, but it is one of the most difficult. And Beethoven's 14th quartet starts in that key, in this slow processional fugue.
You have to imagine, first of all, to write a fugue for an opening movement, no one had ever done that.
Robert Winter is a professor of music at UCLA and one of the world's great authorities on Beethoven. And there's probably no one on the planet who knows more about the 14th quartet. I recorded this interview with Robert Winter in Los Angeles in 2010. With the CD of the performance of the quartet playing in the background, we talked about the music and how it came to be.
C-sharp minor in those days wasn't tuned quite the same as the other keys, so it was a kind of strange place to go, particularly for string players. It's not, unless you played a string instrument, you don't remember that to play in G major, you're playing a lot of open strings on a violin. But you're playing in C-sharp minor, you're playing on no open strings. And you're dying, so that every note has a kind of intensity. His life had kind of come to a point where he'd had to accept he was never going to marry, he was never going to have a family, he was never going to be a regular guy, he's stone deaf, he's losing friends right and left from a process of alienation and death. He's looking right at St. Peter's Gate. He's right there. And yet he has more to say. So I think it isn't just that this begins this way. You've got, I forget exactly how many minutes it is, but it's probably close to 6 minutes of the most intense kind of introspection. Looking at yourself with absolutely no sympathy, maybe some empathy, but looking just straight at what is life about. And going to heaven, it goes higher and higher. Right here. And that's his glimpse of heaven. There's no question. And register was always associated with heaven and hell in Western music. And he comes down again, of course. He comes way down. But he wants us to know. He knows what heaven might be like. As we listen now, it's gone from the two violins into the viola. They'll go into the cello in a moment. It goes right. It floats back down, we might say. But it comes back to earth very emphatically, or very clearly back to earth. And very sadly back to earth. He's sad he can't stay there. He'd like to. In the first overview for this piece, he has the word recitative. That's an operatic term. People sing those. They don't play them. Well, he kept that, and that third movement's very short. Da-da-dum-bum-bum, ba-da-dum-bum. It's meant to be idiotic. It's meant to sound absolutely stupid. And it has no shape or form. It's over in less than a minute. And that movement is designed to set up. You see, this quartet has, there's no piece like Beethoven like it. It has seven movements. The autograph of this piece, most of it's lost. We have the fourth movement, the beautiful variation movement, but we don't have the rest. But the autograph probably ran around 130 pages. The sketches for the quartet run to 650 pages. All right. Now, there are three different kinds, completely different kinds. What we call a desk sketchbook, and he had that at home. He had an ink stand and a quill that he wrote in that with. But then he went out walking at least three times a day. And in his later years, he would take pieces of paper and fold them again in half so he could put them in his coat pockets. He wore those outside with a stubby pencil. He didn't have the pencil sharpeners we have. And he sketched, obviously he would sit down on a log, or it looks often as if he's frankly writing while he's walking. That's how hard it is to read. But remember, this is only for him. He's not interested in you or me reading it. And then when he gets back and he's integrating what he wrote on his walk into his desk sketchbook, and he gets to a certain point, he starts writing what I basically dubbed many years ago as score sketches. So all four parts of the quartet get sketched together. Normally his sketches are one part, one line, or occasionally two parts, maybe a chord here and there, but pretty thin in terms of the overall texture. But the score sketches, of whom there are over 300 for this, I mean, they didn't make it in. He would start writing all four parts, and he'd get to a certain place and say, ah, shit, you know, that didn't work, and he'd go back, and he'd have to start over again. Well, he saved them. He didn't throw them away. Paper was very scarce in those days. You hung on to what you had. So when you're trying to, as I did in chronicling the genesis of this work, you have to really say, okay, he did this maybe at 2 p.m., he did this at 3 p.m., he did this at 4 p.m., in these different score formats as you go back and forth. It's like trying to piece a conversation together that was held in a restaurant by 10 different people or something. It took him many months to create this work. And right around this time, his nephew, whom he had tried to replace the putative mother as the father, but can you imagine having Beethoven for your father? He was firing his cooks and his, you know, wash lady right and left and so on. At this very time, his nephew went up to a hill, took a gun, and literally shot himself in the head. He missed killing himself by about a 16th of an inch, and he was in hospital for several months, so it wasn't a kind of idle cry for help. Well, this was, as you might well imagine, absolutely crushing to Beethoven. And this is right in the middle of writing this piece, and he had to deal with it. And somehow he found, I mean, Beethoven's life is a fascinating one in the sense that, I mean, we always find the link some actual event in a composer's life to some piece of music. This is a very hot thing. People who are first getting into classical music want to, well, how was he feeling then? Did he have a girlfriend? And so on. Beethoven really screwed it up. He had a terrible upbringing, really trying and difficult, abusive parents, I mean, especially his alcoholic father, violent. A lot of inner city kids, a lot of kids in general could relate who are abused, could relate to Beethoven. Beethoven's life was just about as bad as it could possibly get at this point. I mean, in the toilet. I mean, he'd lost Carl. He'd lost everything in his own mind. He didn't have many friends left and so forth. And yet he writes a whole series of late quartets, not just this one, but five. And they will always stand as some of, if not the, you know, greatest corpus of works in Western music. How can you make such a mess of your life, but such a triumph of your art? That's really the question about Beethoven. Here's, by the way, a use of trills in this last variation, which is so bizarre. Trills were meant to end a sentence. That's what a trill is, you know, it ends something. He's just using trills here to make a sound, make a texture, make something wild and crazy. No one had done that before him. And Bartok, you know, takes it straight from him. I mean, when he starts writing his own quartets. Bartok couldn't exist without late Beethoven. There'd be no Bartok at all. Now, this last two bars we're hearing, I just want to say one thing. We just heard the way the quartet ended. But that those last two bars, he sketched 12 times. 12 times, a little teeny cadence that ends the movement. He went nuts. See, he's just going, so Ponticello. They're playing up on the bridge. And when you play right where the bridge is, that little piece of wood that holds the strings up, you get that wild sound, and then now you're going off the bridge. That sounds like the violins that you know. How how he ever got the idea of doing that. No one had, to my knowledge, ever specified Sul Ponticello. Hendrix was a while before he appeared. My guess is that when Beethoven had instruments in his hands, he screwed around in ways that were not prescribed by their teachers or their owners and so forth. He messed around. So I think he probably did, maybe before he went deaf, you know, mess around with playing way up on the bridge. You get this very pinched sound. He loved it. And it's perfect in that place because it's ethereal. It's like up in heaven again. It is incredibly droll humor because it's supposed to be a scherzo, which meaning joke in Italian, but those are in triple meter. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But this is obviously in 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? So he's making a joke at several levels here. You know, one is on the players. The players are thinking, what is this? It's kind of a scherzo, but it's not the right meter. Now what do I do? You know. And it's in a key again with four sharps that requires a lot of thinking on the part of the players as to what they do. In Beethoven's time, only at the very end of his life, in these last quartets, did anyone think, let's have a concert. Because quartets were pick-up basketball. They were players' music. You didn't have an audience. There's a ton of sensational music that was never designed for an audience at all. Now, it's played for audiences today, routinely, but it wasn't designed for them. I found a set of parts for the first movement of this piece that look like they might have been created for some kind of performance. And we don't know anything more about it. Did they just play the first movement? Did they play more of it? We don't know. But, you know, Beethoven wasn't thinking about the audience when he wrote this. And he was rather famous for saying, you know, in one of the quartets, it's just, let's see, two before this one, the Opus 132, someone was complaining about some of the fiddle parts, the violin parts in it. And he scornfully remarked to them, "Do you think I give a about your wretched fiddle?" This is called the giddy-up movement. Da-dum, 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 da-dum. No one ever used this rhythm so unrelentingly as Beethoven. The only time Beethoven ever acknowledged any of his works in any kind of hierarchy was to agree that Opus 131 was the greatest piece he had written to date. Now, he still lived another year, and he wrote a piece or two. But he himself acknowledged this was probably his greatest piece of music. If you're looking at a piece's ability to move you, to get you to question your existence, to think about why you're here, your relationships, what you've done in life, what you wish you hadn't done, what you wish you still had done, and so forth, this piece, I believe, conjures up more of this than almost any piece that I know. So in that sense, I wouldn't disagree with Beethoven. Here we are. This again, this giddy up rhythm, dum da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum, and now it goes ba da dum 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 ba da dum, right? Unrelenting, and then this double stop scale, two notes at once. Never note ever did that. Dum beep beep beep, da dum da dum da dum again. Up. And then down, now, all the way up the scale, ba ba ba, and again down. He's always crouching and sleeping up and so on, right? And when the performers ran across a direction like ritmo di tre battute, that means play it in groups of three. That means three bars at a time. Play it in three bars at a time. No one had ever seen anything like that. It's like my saying, you know, put two one-liners in the same joke. And, you know, if anybody got this far, sight reading was still in the game. You know, slower, softer. We feel like we're in a completely different key than the key of the piece. And even if you don't know any music theory, it doesn't feel final. And now he tries to make it sort of sound final. Now, what I discovered when I was doing sketches, I'll just add this last remark. This ending you and I just heard, which strains to be a resolution, strains to be an answer, strains to finish.
Yeah, it sounds like it ought to finish here.
Yes. Somewhere in there. Yes, yes. And when it's finished, it doesn't really sound finished. He wrote another movement to go after it that goes, and any quartet buff will know this became, or this is today, the slow movement of the only quartet he wrote after this, the Opus 135 quartet. It's in D flat major, a stable key, instead of this very gnarly C sharp minor. And it takes all the notes of the fugue, da-da-dee-dum, da-da-dee-da-da-da-dum, all those notes, and makes them smooth and diatonic, meaning intelligible, easy to understand, and strings them together and has this sort of very sweet ending. And finally, he's almost done with it, he says, wait a minute, I'm Beethoven. I don't do that. Rips it off and ends here. So this was the most courageous moment in the quartet, actually, to leave people on the cliff. That's you and me and everyone else who will have the privilege of listening.
Robert Winter is a professor of music at UCLA. He's one of the world's great authorities on Beethoven and the 14th Quartet. You can see the score he brought to the interview by going to Flickr. Just use the search terms Connected Social Media and Beethoven. And you can easily find his bio by going to Google or Bing and using the search terms Robert Winter and UCLA.